Christian Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Hello, Jim. Happy Friday.
And same to you, Marjorie.
Thank you.
You know, a ton has happened since we left you yesterday at 2 o'clock relative to the Marathon bombings and the Tsarnaevs. Here is 22 hours in a minute.
Jahar Tsarnaev has been speaking with federal investigators, and he allegedly has been telling them that the 4th of July celebration here on the Esplanade was the original
Several
target.
Breaking developments tonight. CBS News reporting that Jahar Tsarnaev told investigators about the plan for the 4th when investigators were questioning him in the hospital, admitting that he and his older brother Tamerlan made the bombs in his brother's apartment in Cambridge. Also tonight, the New York Times reports, contrary to what her lawyer says, Tamerlan's wife, Catherine, has stopped cooperating with
information on Tamerlan Tsarnaev's widow. Investigators say that she got a phone call from her husband days after the attack. And the New York Times reports that she stopped cooperating with investigators. She has insisted, of course, that she knew nothing about
the lawyer who's overseeing the fund says the three families who lost relatives in the explosions will get, quote, well over $1 million in payments. Smaller amounts will then be given to people who were hurt. And those payments are expected to be distributed by the end of the month.
Yeah, there's the additional thing of the body of the older terrorist
right.
in this case.
Well, a helicopter followed the hearse as it drove down to a funeral home in North Attleboro.
North Attleboro, yeah.
And it sort of sparked a little outrage among the neighbors. They were out there protesting that the body of Tamerlan was there. I mean, he's got to go to a funeral home, obviously. But I think what's going to be a fascinating development today is there was question about how Tamerlan actually died, if he was killed by gunshots at the scene of the Watertown shootout or if he was killed when his brother ran him over in the getaway car. Mm. So as early as today, we'll find out exactly what caused Tamerlan Tsarnaev's death.
Now, the last story in that montage was about the draft proposal by Ken Feinberg. He's the guy who's in charge of the One Fund Boston. To give $1 million to families of those killed and to those who lost two limbs, lesser amounts to others. You know, it says this much for two limbs, this much for one. You know, that's what he's got to do. But it sounds so, I don't know if mercenary is the right, that isn't the, you know what I mean? It sounds so something. It's weird. In any case, it is terrific that the public has been so generous. Right before it went on the air, I checked One Fund Boston's site. $28.5 million as of showtime. But there's one issue that lingers. You know, last week we had Ken Feinberg with us. And Marjorie pointed out that every year in every inner city, hundreds of people get killed. They don't get money. There's no official fund for them. They just suck it up. Here's how Feinberg responded to Marjorie's point.
Now, it isn't all that often that a tragedy is so public and so impacts the nation that people voluntarily contribute private money. It does raise questions of fairness and equal protection. But I must say, these funds are all Aurora and Virginia Tech and Newtown and the Boston Marathon, One Fund Boston. These are all private reactions to a public tragedy. So, you know, that's America. And some tragedies rise to a level of contribution. Some don't.
That's Ken
Feinberg. That's our system.
That's Ken Feinberg. He says it does raise questions of fairness and equal protection. So that's America. And some tragedies rise to a level of contribution and some don't. And that's our question at 877-301-8970. We want to talk about those which don't. Those which don't cause either leaders to decide that money should be raised, they don't put together a fund, and those that cause people who suffered, we would argue, and I'm sure, I hope you would agree, equally horrible personal losses to essentially get nothing.
Well, there at least have been 25 people shot in Boston since the marathon. Three people in Boston were killed in the month of April, and we don't know about them because they are tragically so frequent. You know, because I have a second job at the Boston Herald and I've interviewed a lot of survivors of crime, I mean, this one particular woman who's called me a couple of times. She lost her son. He had nothing to do with a gang. He never did anything wrong. He was totally in the wrong place at the wrong time and he was shot in the head and killed. His name is Cedric Steele, and she has been trying to move out of her apartment now for several years, and she can't.
Doesn't have the money for it.
Because she doesn't have money for it. I'll never forget, she said to me one day, you know, Marjorie, you're going to go home after you finish talking to me here to your nice home in Brookline, and Mayor Menino is going to go back to his nice home in Hyde Park, and Ed Davis is going to go back. And I'm here with my other son who has to walk out the front door every day. I'm going to lose my other son, too, the way I lost my first son. So I can't imagine how hard it is for her to know that she could get like $5,000 maybe and move to another place, but she's not going to get it, and someone else gets $1 million. It's hard to reconcile that.
So that's our question. Ken Feinberg raised it perfectly. It does raise questions of fairness and equal protection. And what's your reaction to it? Some rise to the level of a contribution, he said, and some don't. 877-301-8970. You know, I have to say, well, I've thought a lot about this through the years. You and I have discussed it really on the air and off the air since 9/11. But the way you just framed it is perfect. Is that family that's sitting at home that's worried about protecting their other kid?
Exactly.
And they're
petrified.
And they're watching. And I assume, I mean, we know a lot of these people. I mean, a lot of these people come to the march we go to every year, the Mother's Day March for Peace, which is a week from Sunday. We're going to talk to Tina Cherry next week, who's the leader of that. And I've never heard resentment. It isn't like people say, I don't want them to get anything.
She's never. I've asked her about this before, because I asked her about this Tina Cherry in the context of 9/11.
Yeah.
Because Tina Cherry is going every year hat in hand to try to get money
to anybody, everybody.
The city. I think she has a budget of like $250,000. And she does great work in her center. By the way, you know who she gets money from?
Yeah.
She gets money from prisoners. She has this book of money from $10 from some guy at some state penitentiary and $20 from some guy in the Suffolk County lockup and stuff. She gets money from them. But she does this whole Peace Institute where she tries to help people overcome and deal with the violence that they suffer on a daily basis in Boston, which, by the way, is small potatoes when you consider bigger cities like Chicago, where there's just a terrible homicide effort. But she has to go begging for money every year to keep her operation going. And it's just hard to reconcile those two things.
And by the way, she's also called in a great piece in the Globe a few years ago, wedding planner for funerals. What she does is the vast majority of people who are killed in the inner city go to her. What do we do? How do we talk about our son or daughter or brother or sister or husband? How do we talk to the media? What do we say about him at the service? I mean, she's sort of a one-stop. But anyway, it's not just her, but there is a fundamental unfairness. And maybe that's the way the world is. And maybe the reality is things that are stunningly high profile are going to be what gets attention. And we should just grow up and realize that there's that distinction. But the point you made about that woman, the mother, wanting to move out of her house, that probably cost a couple $1,000s. I mean, it's not short money for her, but it's short money in the context of the kind of money that's being raised for One Fund Boston. And it seems to me, not only is there a fundamental unfairness, but you say to yourself, is it incumbent upon leaders who rose up, I thought, beautifully in the wake of April 15th in the marathon and championed this cause? Is it incumbent on them to go to the same sort of foundations and corporations and individuals and say, do something for those people too?
Well, we've called the attacks on Boston at the marathon terrorism, right?
Because
they were terrorism. But I think you could make an argument that there is these terror zones in the inner cities of America where parents are afraid to let their kids out of the house, where parents are afraid to let their kids walk anywhere at all, because, you know, what's funny about Boston is you drive through neighborhoods of Boston. Bowdoin and Geneva is a very dangerous part of Boston in terms of shootings, but you drive by there, it doesn't look dangerous. It doesn't look like a particularly scary part of town. But shootings happen there in broad daylight. They happen at Dudley in broad daylight. So people are living in these terror zones where they're thinking all the time, how do I get my kid from after school to their choir practice at church? Remember the kid that was shot on the way to his choir practice just earlier this year? So they are terror zones. There's daily terrorism, and they don't get the attention. Now, I don't know if it's just race, because the majority of people in the inner city are black, or in Cape Verdean, or if it's because of poverty. We just kind of expect those things in poor neighborhoods, which isn't fair either. I don't know what it is.
Or that it happens all the time, and marathon bombings don't happen all the time. 877-301-8970. Let's start in Bridgewater, where Jack is on Boston Public Radio with Jim and Marty. Jack, thank you for the call.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Just a quick comment.
Please.
The discussion's kind of shifted to, you know, a question of the fund, and now that all the investigation's kind of wrapping up and everyone's done their job and everything. You know, I just want to raise a comment, and then you guys can you know, take it from there. But, you know, like, let's say hypothetically there wasn't a fund and, you know, you got people lying in hospital beds with no limbs and stuff. The first thing that would happen is the question of liability would be raised and, you know, the lawyers would then get involved. And
well, let me comment. Let me comment right now. One of the first questions that Ken Feinberg was asked at the press conference on the day that he was announced as the master leader of this was, does this, unlike the 9/11 fund, where if you took money from that, it was government money, you agreed not to sue anybody? Here it has nothing to do with it. Every single one of these people, if they choose, could go get a lawyer. They could go sue whoever they choose. So this doesn't preclude anything. You know what I mean?
Well, it lessens the burden on the people that have been injured to actually
trying to
get some kind of recompense
from some
kind of entity. And they may feel good enough with the money they get to say, well, you know, we're getting taken care of. Our medical bills are being paid. You know,
yep.
You know, why should we sue people now? And, you know, it is a way that, you know, covers somewhat a question of liability on, you know, the organizers of the event, in general.
You mean as a practical matter, not legally. You mean as a practical matter. I think you're right. In many cases, it will. Jack, thanks.
Thank you.
We appreciate your point.
For the call. Curtis in Westboro, thank you for calling Boston Public Radio. What do you think, Curtis?
Hi. I think this may point to a bit of a larger problem in society, which is we've become decoupled from each other humanity-wise, and we try to commodify everything.
Mm-hmm.
And so we try to put price tags or say that, you know, let's throw money at a particular problem or whatnot, instead of recognizing that attention, I think, is more of a needed for certain problems. And so instead of trying to maybe change underlying causes of economic inequality that might cause certain problems, we just try to throw money as a Band-Aid after the problem, and then the underlying problems we kind of put off to the side.
That was a brilliant call.
Yeah.
Curtis, did you hear Ken Feinberg when he was on with us a couple of weeks ago?
No, I did not.
He told a story that originally had been in a Brian McGorry column in The Globe about how when he was administering the 9/11 fund, every single person, except I think two, had applied for money, and the deadline was rapidly approaching. And one of the two people was a mother who lived in Brooklyn. And he took the subway out to Brooklyn, and he asked the woman, why haven't you done it? And he says, I'll help you fill out the forms. I know they're complex. I'll do anything you want. And I'm paraphrasing what she said, but it's a variation of what you said. My son is gone, and you want to write me a check in compensation and she would have gotten somewhere in the neighborhood of $2 million. He said, do whatever you want with it. Give it to charity. Set up a foundation in the name of your kid. And she said, essentially, what you're saying is that you're attempting to monetize something that really can't ever be done in that fashion. So, Curtis, great point, and thank you very much for the call. 877-301-8897. The thing that's sticking with me, again, is the thing you said. It's not the abstract discussion of fairness and equality. It's like the person who has suffered a grievous loss, particularly in Boston. It happens all over the country, but since the One Fund Boston is Boston-focused,
right,
who can't afford to move their kid, who can't afford to move to another floor, who can't afford to do something. It's horrifying.
You know, one of the things, and our question, by the way, in case you didn't hear it when we first asked it, is how do we reconcile the fact that generous people in Boston and around Boston have raised $28 million for the One Fund Boston that's going to help the victims of the survivors of the Boston Marathon tragedy, and yet we have had 24 shootings in Boston, 3 deaths in April since 24 shootings since the marathon, 3 deaths in April in Boston alone. And we're a very small city, obviously, and nobody's getting nothing there. So how do we reconcile? How do we reconcile that? I think there should be sort of a Gold Star Mothers program in Boston, where if you lose your child to violence, there should be something you get. Certainly counseling.
You should say what a Gold Star Mother is.
Well, Gold Star Mothers are mothers who've lost their sons or now daughters in military service. And I think one of the great misunderstandings is that a lot of the children, they're mostly children, teenagers, that get killed in Boston are killed because they're doing something bad. Lots of times they're not doing anything. It's because the ones with the guns are bad shots, or they mistake them for somebody else, or they're shooting into a crowd and they miss. They're just people kind of walking through areas that you consider mm-hmm. to be relatively safe. So they should get something. One of the things Tina Cherry does in her programs, she makes these programs for funerals. So when you go to a funeral, it tells you, like you said, how to deal with the media. But it also tells you books to get. So when the 7-year-old says, am I still a sister? because my big brother or big sister is dead, then you have a book to give to your kid to say, yes, you still are a sister. Psychological counseling, you know, maybe if a little bit of money. So if you're a Gold Star mother, you have, I don't know, $1,000 so you can get counseling for your family to deal with this tragedy, mental health services, anything.
Don't you think also that if leaders, if a Tom Menino or Deval Patrick stood up and said, after this effort is over, there are other people who have suffered grievous losses in and around Boston, we'd urge you. They might not raise $28.5 million, which is what they raised by noon today, but I sense people are pretty generous.
Well, I think people feel terrible about it. They don't know what to do about
exactly.
it. You know, you may live in a suburb of Boston and read about these terrible things in the paper. You're like, what do I do? What do I do?
Well, that's why you have leaders. If Menino had not set up this thing, they wouldn't have raised $28.5 million.
Exactly.
Let's go to Nahant, where Gretchen's on the phone. Welcome, Gretchen.
Hello, you both. You know, this is very touching and very compelling. And the points that you have made just recently are parts of the points that I wanted to make. So, you know, kudos to Tina Cherry. She is a wonderful woman.
She's great.
And I think that, you know, she just picked up and did it. You know, she did. She didn't have a big bureaucracy behind her. She did it.
By the way, before you continue, Gretchen, the one thing we didn't say about it is it started because her son, Lewis Brown, and it's called Lewis D. Brown Peace Institute, was going to a peace meeting in her neighborhood, and he's killed.
Again.
What a heartbreak.
Yeah, but people should know.
And to have the courage to come from that.
I agree.
And to do, but whatever. Okay, so, but what I kind of think is that earlier in the conversation, we were talking about why $28 million for this and why not for the poor woman who's, you know, needs to leave that apartment that she's in. And I think it does have to do with awareness. Like, until today, Marjorie, I wasn't aware of that woman. But I'm sitting here thinking, you know, I'm probably 25, 30 miles from her. So I'd never run into her. I'd never meet her. I wouldn't get it, you know.
Yeah.
And we did run into those people in the marathon. We did meet them. We heard them, whatever. But what I'm saying is there is someone who does see that woman. And if what we could do is when we see something like that, partner with the person and help them to raise the money. Like, I'm thinking I would much rather give my $10 this week to that woman than to give it to church where I know where it's going. You know,
Of course, never know where it's going if you're giving it in a Catholic church, Gretchen.
I mean.
Who knows?
That's what I mean. I know where it's going, Marjorie. It's going to lawsuits. It's going to the corruption and all kinds of other crap. So I bet that there are at least 50 people this week who could give $10, and we'd be getting there with this woman. She'd be able to move.
Yeah.
And so, you know, in this particular case, I'd like to speak with you. Maybe I could help organize something around.
Gretchen, you know what you can do?
Person.
Why don't you send us an email? It's BPR, Boston Public Radio. BPR at WGBH.
BPR.
As in Boston Public Radio.
At
WGBH.org. Hey, Gretchen, it's great to talk to you as always. We appreciate
it. Take care.
Bye-bye. Bye.
You know, we should say, by the way, that Tina Cherry's march, which happens every Mother's Day, a lot of people from the suburbs come in.
Oh, they do.
To march. A lot of church groups come in to march. So you do get a big crowd of people. And people do care. I think people are very compassionate. And they, my newspaper, the Boston Herald, has covered crime in the city quite comprehensively for many, many years now.
Let's go to Everett, where Vivian is on Boston Public Radio with Jim and Marjorie. Welcome, Vivian.
Hi, welcome. Thank you for taking my call.
We're happy you made it.
Thank you. I just would like to say that what happened here in Boston was very personal and it has nothing to do with urban violence because I am Black, I am a woman, I am for a poor class, and I managed to go to college. I'm a senior at Northeastern University, and still, even with all the financial issues I'm having, I donate some money from the one fund. Because when a terror attack happened, it's not an ordinary shooting because people die every day and it's unfortunate, but it happened. But when someone, by hate, just drop a bomb and kill people to your neighbors, you know, your teachers, your friends, I have a lot of friends in there and I almost went there, you know?
Yeah.
So it's different. So, you know what I'm saying? So you pay with a little love to kind of minimize all this hate that someone just spew on you.
Yeah, but
you're right. But I think that there's obviously hate elsewhere, Vivian. And I guess that's the thing. It's hard to reconcile for me anyway. But
Vivian, thanks for your call, as always. I'm sorry, what?
What I would say is just, like, it's different because I mean, someone has hate on them when they shoot someone else, but it's not something that you relate to because shooting happens all the time.
Yeah, but that's exactly, you know? Vivian, exactly our point is, I think you said it well, our point is we should figure out a way to relate to it and realize that people are suffering, who suffered major losses, are ones for whom we should be as generous as most of us have been, so many of us have been, towards the One Fund Boston. Vivian, thank you so much for your call. We appreciate it.
Okay, up next on Boston Public Radio, what stories have been completely dwarfed by the Boston Marathon bombing headlines? A lot of them. And Callie Crossley is here to bring us that conversation on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
The 48th annual WGBH Spring Auction is on.
It's your chance to support the programs you love and get some great deals while you're at it.
You can bid on jewelry, electronics, unforgettable vacations.
Like a trip down the Blue Danube, adventures in Machu Picchu and the Azores.
Even a Beatles theme cruise.
A magical mystery tour.
Okay, please stop.
Sorry. And every winning bid supports the programs you count on.
See all the deals and place your bids online at auction.wgbh.org.
This program is made possible thanks to you and Boston Private Bank, helping business owners, entrepreneurs, nonprofits, and families manage their banking and investment needs. This is your time. This is your private bank. Boston Private Bank. BostonPrivateBank.com. And Goddard House Assisted Living in Brookline and their Bed, Breakfast, and Beyond program, a 2, 3, or 4 week stay without a long-term commitment. You'll be safe and secure in assisted living with the comforts of a country inn. GoddardHouse.org.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. You hear her every Sunday night at 6:30 on Under the Radar with Callie Crossley, and you hear her every Friday, well, not the exact same time, but sort of sometime between 12 and 1 with us. Welcome back, Callie Crossley. How are you, Callie?
Hey, Jim. Hey, Marjorie.
How are you, Callie?
Okay.
So what is our little homeboy, Ben Affleck, up to? I love this story.
It's my homeboy, if you don't mind. Well, actually,
Callie's
yours, too. That's right.
I live in Cambridge.
Cambridge kids, yeah.
I'm just really proud of him. I'm always impressed by people who do things that they don't have to do. And the only reason that I think it's made public, and I'll say what it is in a minute, is because he's trying to raise awareness of how many people live in poverty and barely survive on and what is the economists have told us is $1.50 a day. So he started a little thing for himself to eat rice and beans, and then he wrote about it in several places to talk to people about understanding the massive economic inequality going on. And isn't there a way that all of us can work a little harder to make some of this just make some of the gap close? And for him, he's doing it with his Eastern Congo initiative specifically. And also in his piece in the Huffington Post, he referenced Feeding America so that people won't say, well, why are you doing it out of the country and not here? Here's a quote from his Huffington piece that he wrote, and I thought this was great. He says, there are valid criticisms of this effort. Some accuse it of making the issue of extreme poverty into little more than celebrity twister. It is also true that celebrities often promote knowing or unknowing lifestyles that price out all but the richest Americans. Why should they be lecturing Americans on poverty? Fair enough. But then he goes on to say, but you know what? I'm going to do my part. And so on these days, I'm eating these rice and beans and I'm writing about it. And you can criticize me if you like. But
you know,
here's what I'm doing.
What could you really? I mean, $1.50 a day. Could you even get a bottle of water for $1.50 a day?
And he wrote it. He said, it's tough. He said, I'm doing bottled water with my rice and beans. And by the way, that's pushing up against the limit.
Let's go back. Yeah. $1.50 is what? That a billion people or something on the planet eat and live on what is the equivalent of $1.50?
Exactly. Let me say, the U.S. has 5% of the world's population and 35% of global wealth. But then there are some million people who are living or subsisting really on $1.50 a day.
You know, I have to say, you know, a lot of my friends mock these kinds of things.
Your friend, the congressman, did it.
What? I was just going to say, Jim McGovern. Remember Jim McGovern? I think it was 2000.
He's eating food stamps.
In 2000, he wasn't eating food stamps.
There was a group of people
he was living on food stamps for a week or something.
Remember,
in 2007?
There was a group of congresspersons that did that? Yeah. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I do.
That
actually
was really impressive because some of them went into it saying, oh, these people bitching and moaning, blah, blah, blah. And then they found out how tough it was.
Wait a minute. You mean I misunderstood it all this time?
He didn't eat the food stamps, Margie. No, he lived on food stamps for a week. Oops. And by the way, what they did, you're exactly right. Yeah. If I recall correctly, they challenged the McGoverns and others who were central to this, challenged others to do it. And it does bring awareness. So, even if people criticize it as a celebrity stunt, the reality is people talk about it, and it gets people thinking. And you say, when I read this story for the first time, I am, what is the great Lily Tomlin line? No matter how cynical I get, I just can't keep up.
Yeah.
I mean, that's generally me.
Uh-huh.
But the reality is, after being cynical, I said to myself, $1.50 a day?
Right.
I mean, hello?
Yeah.
I mean, what's a cup of coffee cost across the street at Dunkin' Donuts? $1.79? Whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, whatever
coffee.
It is, it's unbelievable.
That's one item. And remember, you know, we all talked about this when the Pope was installed because he was raising the issue of poverty. And this were some of the statistics that came out at the same time as he was raising it, saying, hey, people, this is what's going on in the world.
What's going on with him? By the way, he got off to an incredible start. I hadn't even thought about it, with a poor thing. And then not only going to the prison to wash the feet, but of women and men and doing the whole poverty thing. What, we heard anything
haven't
from
heard much lately.
The Pope Francis in the last couple of weeks?
Not much late. He just moved into his new refurbished apartment. But remember, he didn't want to go. So I'm interested to know. I'm sure somebody will report on exactly what's inside that apartment.
Is he sharing that with Benedict or is he not?
No, Benedict is in the countryside.
Oh, sorry. No, he's back from the country. I think he came back a day or two ago.
He's out of the papal villa out there in the...
Hey, Kelly, we...
With his little red shoes.
At the top of the show, we played a composite of an incredible number of things we've learned about the Tsarnaevs and pre- and post-marathon things, literally in the last 24 hours. What was your reaction when you heard that July 4th was their intended target, with literally, instead of whatever number of people at the finish line, let's say 5,000, 8,000, whatever it was, 500,000 people in one place, densely packed. Mm. What was your reaction to that?
My reaction was similar to my reaction about what happened at Patriots Day, because part of the intensity and the emotion around that event is that it's a family event. And if you want to think of another event in Boston, even more family, it's July 4th. And so I started thinking about these bombs were planted low to the ground. People are on the ground on the Esplanade. I mean, we're talking horror that I can't even imagine. And then it would have, then the musicians on the stage. I mean, it just goes on and on and on.
Yeah.
And plus, talk about people trying to get out of a space. Where would you go? Where would you run from? You wouldn't have any sense of where the bombs were going off.
I'd like to be the security people dealing with this thing.
I would not.
I mean, it's pretty tough in normal times. Can you imagine the anticipation leading up to this thing come July 4th?
Well, they're preparing for it.
To your point, Callie, it's so clear that the reason that all the people, the hundreds that were injured, survived, many of them, is because they were so close to the medical tent at the marathon, right there at the finish line. Mm. They were rushed over there in wheelchairs. They were taken to the hospital. That would have been impossible to do.
Well, that's because of the traffic. Now, because Boston's so small, the Esplanade is still close to the medical, center of Boston. So you could get there within minutes. But, of course, I don't know that is there a medical tent at the Esplanade?
I was just going to say, but wouldn't
there
it be scary?
Not
it's
like there
be
is
small.
For the
no, not for the marathon,
How
though.
Scary would that be if you're going to the July 4th, the Esplanade, and you see this huge array of doctors and nurses and anticipate, by the way, last week, Keith Lockhart was here, who obviously is the guy on top of the whole thing on July 4th. This is before the story came out in the last 24 hours about what the original goal of the Tsarnaevs was. Listen, first it's me, and then you'll hear what Lockhart had to say. I'm guessing that already that all of the people who work on this are already working on making sure everybody's safe on July 4th, yes?
It was one of the first conversations that I had when I got home. Obviously, this is not the part that I'm most directly responsible for, but we've already done it, and I know much more has been going on. Obviously, we had a similar conversation after 9/11. It's this normal balance you have between great, free, wonderful public events that use, like the marathon or the 4th of July, that use huge amounts of space and are really not 100% securable.
Everybody's gone out of their way, both runners and viewers, for lack of a better expression, to say, we're going back to next year's marathon. If we didn't run it, we're going to run it. I mean, even people who've lost limbs have talked about running it next year. Everybody says they want to be a volunteer. But there is going to be some fear. And
of course.
I mean, is there
not? Well, there's fear now. Honestly, there are some people that just say, I want to go back because I want to support those businesses on Boylston Street, but I feel a little...
But I'm talking July 4th. Yeah. I mean, that's the Sarnaevs are out of commission. One's dead, one's in the can, probably for the rest of his life if he's not executed by the state at the end of this thing. But it really is.
You know, I think it's frankly a thought that you have in the back of your mind almost any time since 9/11. I mean, the times I've been to Gillette, which is only once or twice, I've thought about it. The times I've been to Fenway, I've thought about it. I've even thought about it in shopping malls. Mm-hmm. It's just sort of there, this idea that we're vulnerable now almost every place you go.
But see, I think it's so different when once it happened. I mean, this has been said only for the 10,000th time. You know, one of those was in Oregon. One of them was wherever they were. All of a sudden, it's in our own backyard.
Well,
they came from
came
here.
Out
it's
of
true.
Boston.
Right.
You know, one of the things, yesterday we took calls on the whole issue of these three 19-year-old friends of Jahar essentially attempting, if the allegations are accurate, to cover his tracks. After the what was your reaction? So we have four 19-year-olds, Jahar and these three buddies of his from UMass Dartmouth. What was your reaction there?
I have a really high bar for friendship, so I don't really call everybody a friend. I have very close acquaintances. So when I think about somebody investing their emotional energy into a friendship and think, will it rise to the level of covering up what you now know? I'm sorry. I can't go with them. They didn't know.
I'm with you.
If you start taking stuff out of the room, even if you don't know, you fear something. So why are you taking stuff out of the room? You know, you wouldn't do that.
Well, there are also two pre-existing facts. Is one, the dinner some of them, if not all of them, had with him a month before the bombing, where he said, I now know how to make a bomb thanks to the internet, and the tweeting that went by. So the evidence is overwhelming.
They looked at the pictures, and remember we had untold numbers of people who didn't take things out of the room who said, my God, that picture looks just, but it couldn't be because they're just such nice kids. Here's what happens when you have a friend. You allow them wide berth. You know how many friends you have? We all know. We can think of them now who do stuff that if you were just meeting that person right now, you would never have them in your group of people that you associate with.
But they're
your
friend.
But you've given them a pass.
Right, exactly.
But,
that's
you know,
great.
Where does your past, where does that end, though? And I can't, I know they're young and they're foolish. And I started thinking back to foolish stuff I did when I was that age, but I don't think I'd go there.
Well, you know what's, you know what's really chilling? There's a timeline in the Herald today that just after 9 o'clock, these three guys were in Johar's room at UMass Dartmouth, where they saw the backpack filled with the fireworks with the powder emptied out. That was just after 9 o'clock. At 10:29, MIT police officer Sean Collier was found dead in his cruiser. So there's almost an hour and a half during which it's very possible if these young men had called the cops could have been, they were in their apartment.
Well, they knew what the address was.
They were there
exactly
in their
right.
apartment. They could have been there, and we could have had his life saved and also the police officer.
You know, I'm so glad you did that, by the way, because, you know, so many people have said, even though they're not trying to make excuses, I assume, for these three guys, listen, it was after the fact. What they did was stupid and whatever. However, I think you make the case there that we were touching on yesterday is that if they had acted quickly and done what they should have done instead of trying to dispose of Jahar's crap, but rather called the authorities, it's conceivable Sean Collier would not be dead.
Absolutely. Don't you think if they called the FBI in an hour and a half, the FBI could have called the local Cambridge Police Department and would have showed up outside the apartment?
But let's just say that they didn't call the FBI, that they figured out, oh, God, that must be he. But then why are you going in his room to take stuff out? Now, you know, whether you called or not for whatever it stopped you, why are you going in to take stuff out? I just don't get that.
Said it great. You give him a wide berth, but not that wide.
Not even close. I just can't. And I don't think it's maturity. I think it has something to do with, you know, how we feel about relationships and how are you screwed up thinking about what a friendship really is?
Yeah.
I mean, a friend also has wide berth to tell you the hard stuff. That's what a friend is. It's, you know, I'm sorry, Aretha, but I always say Aretha Franklin didn't have any girlfriends because nobody tells her how to dress. But, you know, but I'm just saying, you know, that's what I'm saying. You have a wide berth for someone to tell you some hard stuff you don't want to hear, right?
Yeah.
So
it's
supposed to work both ways.
Well, every time we talk about this, I go right back to Whitey Bulger and Billy Bulger. You know, I can't help thinking there about the allegations for years around here that Billy Bulger did know much more than he's ever admitted about what his brother Whitey was doing. Of course, Whitey's accused of, I think, 20 murders, and Billy knew more than that, and yet protected him because he was his brother.
Yeah.
He did indeed.
Well, that's okay. And I have, you know, that's maybe you say that's a familial relationship, and that calls into question some other things.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think that birth doesn't include brother as serial killer.
I don't either. I agree with you. I agree with you, but I'm just saying some people might say, well, you know, that's my brother. I'm sorry. I'm just not going to say. But this is your friend. I'm using the air quotes.
No, my sister was stealing the neighbor's newspapers, and I turned her right in.
You did not. Is that true? Did you really?
No, I'm only teasing.
I think she did. Okay, Callie, 6:30 Under the Radar with Callie Crossley every Sunday night. What's on tap?
There has been a lot of conversation, as you may well know, about some of the Northeastern's move to expand into dormitories and the deal that they have with a big company to tear down the dorms, remove that historical Y that's there, and also build these condominiums and also build some other dorms that are needed for an increased population of students. But so that would mean that there's an absence of all affordable health care in the area. I mean, not health care, fitness center in the area. Mm-hmm. And that's been a gathering space for a lot of people. So this South End Fitness Center held an open house. It's been there a while. Some people know about it. Other people don't. Lots of folks come from across town and have trained there. And they have a pool and a basketball court. And they deliberately keep the regular membership to, you know, low. And then they have discounted for seniors and others in the neighborhood. And if you're talking about making certain that all members of the community still feel involved, even if there are big changes with luxury condos, I think that's important. One thing that I thought was a brilliant compromise suggestion, the people who are building these high rises say, well, we can only do so much. We'll think about your proposal to preserve this center. That's what the folks are asking. But we need $5 more million to build the luxury condominiums. And Dr. Robert Sims, who's a rheumatologist at the Boston Medical Center, and this comes from the South End News, said, hey, our suggestion is, why don't you charge the luxury people more? They're not expecting to come cheap. And then that way, that funds the ability
that's
to keep
them.
Isn't that a great
idea?
What's wrong with that?
Who's going to be with you? Who's with you?
I have the great and all-powerful Sue O'Connell with me. Also,
we love Sue O'Connell.
The wonderful Peter Katsas and the absolutely insightful John Roche.
That's a pretty good group.
Yes.
That's a
night,
great idea.
6:30
Pay more.
All right, you go, girl.
Yeah.
Marjorie, she's on fire. Callie Crossley, good luck. We'll be listening Sunday night, and thanks so much for being with us.
All right, thank you.
Callie Crossley, as Jim just said, host of Under the Radar every Sunday night at 6:30.
Excuse me, Under the Radar with Callie Crossley.
I'm sorry.
Thank you.
You're welcome, Callie. I did that for you, my friend.
I stand corrected. They didn't eat the food stamps either. I was wrong about that, too. Okay. Under the Radar with Callie Crossley. I don't mean to be down. We're a little bit down today, Jim. These are sort of tough topics. But anyway, lead paint and car seats and stepladders, all the things that are dangerous for children. So how come they can own a rifle when they're 5 years old? Stay tuned to that conversation on Boston Public Radio.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie. You're right. There's not much upbeat stuff so far. We're going to pick it up maybe in the second hour. You know, the debate in Congress about gun control rages on in the states as well, where senators who voted no on that Toomey-Manchin compromise on background checks like Kelly Ayotte in New Hampshire and Jeff Flake in Arizona, who Jeff Flake refers to himself on his Facebook page as pond scum in the minds of most of his constituents because they voted off. Obviously, it's going to be at the center of the Gomez-Markey race as well. We don't want to talk about any of that. We want to talk about one particular horrible happening on Tuesday in Kentucky when a little 5-year-old boy who'd been given a .22 caliber rifle as a gift, 5 years old, shot and killed his 2-year-old sister. Now, I know you've all heard about this story, but we want to fill in a couple of blanks, and then we have a question for you at 877-301-8970. The gun in question was made by a company called, it's Crickets is what it's called, with two T's. If you go to their website to try to hear the commercial that targets these little kids, you can't see it because the website has been taken down. But essentially, it's advertised as your first rifle. It's called Crickets. On the packaging, Marjorie, of the rifle, so it appeals to kids more, there's a cartoon drawing of a cricket and to appeal to little girls of 5 years old or thereabouts. You know what color their rifles are?
Pink.
Hot pink rifles. And so we want to know, following up on what Marjorie asked it a minute ago, how is it that kids can have rifles but can't live in a house with lead paint? They can't wear flammable pajamas, which they shouldn't, by the way. But the question at 877-301-8970 is, why is any kid at 5 years old allowed to have a firearm? It is so incredible to me. And when I heard quotes from, I think it's Cumberland County, it's called in Kentucky, from everybody from the coroner to the sheriff to people in the community basically saying, you know, the kid knew how to use the rifle. Obviously, he didn't know how to use the rifle. He's 5 years old. He's 5 years old. What's the name of that lawyer? It drives me nuts. The guy who comes out every year, whatever
Schwartz.
His name is, Schwartz. You know, the 20 most dangerous toys
right.
around Christmas.
Yep.
All these toys
the
you can't give to your kid. Right,
because
they're
going to
swallow
them.
It.
Yeah.
But a kid can have a gun. And we want to know if you share our view, and I know I speak for Marjorie here, that though they can't do background checks and they can't ban assault weapons and they can't ban in Congress high-capacity magazines, could you join us in calling for members of Congress, including those who are owned by the NRA, to say that maybe there's a cutoff age that below X, 6, 7, a kid can't own a firearm?
It should have to be 7.
It is so staggering
crazy.
To me. And
I
by the way,
I don't get it. I don't get that whole mentality. I just don't. You know, I do know people always say, you know in Massachusetts here in Brookline where I live, nobody's buying little toy guns for their kids anymore. Their
toy
little boys.
Guns, right.
Yeah, toy guns. But you will find your little boys in the schoolyard. They're all making the shooting sound, you know, the shooting motion lots of times with their hands, although they'll turn the inside of a paper towel, the cardboard inside of a paper towel into like a gun kind of thing. So boys tend to do these things. But, you know, at least around here, people don't buy toy guns anymore at all. So I just don't get the mentality of buying your child a real gun. And as you mentioned before, you know, there's all these regulations about hammocks and cribs and car seats.
Everything that relates to kids.
877-301-8970 is our number. 877-301-8970.
Listen to the quote from the Cumberland County's Kentucky coroner. Just one of those crazy accidents, he said. And then there's a photograph on, if you go to Mother Jones' website, they have a photograph. Again, the website is down, Cricket's website. It's Cricket's with two T's website, which is the manufacturer of these My First Rifles, you know, guns for kids. They have a section called the Kids Corner page in which they have smiling photographs of young kids. Some look as old as maybe 11, 12, holding rifles, but some are as young as 18 months or
well,
2 years.
They've got the picture of the little child who's sitting there. It looks like he just learned to walk, you know, a few months before.
If that.
He's sitting there with the rifle across his lap. I mean, I don't get it. I didn't, and even when you hear about people that grew up in the hunting culture, they went out hunting with their dads and their grandpas and three generations and stuff like that, usually they're a little bit older. Remember the terrible tragedy at the shooting range a couple of years ago?
In Western Mass, the kid from Connecticut.
And he was, I think.
Is that what you're talking about?
Yes. He was so young that the blowback from the gun when he shot it, that's not the right word, but when you get jolted backwards.
That he ended up shooting himself.
He ended up shooting himself because he was a young child, too young to be strong enough to manage that blowback from the gun. So I just don't understand it. 877-301-8970. And, you know, when you think of the other extremes, I mean, you got your buddy down there, Mayor Bloomberg in New York City, who wants to regulate the size of sodas you can drink. And he actually did. I mean, it's just kind of crazy.
By the way, you know, if you want to teach your kid, I assume we're going to get calls, which is obviously fine, that people say, well, you want to teach a child, particularly in this environment, in 2013, gun safety. Listen, that's fine. The notion of teaching a kid gun safety, I don't know what the appropriate age is one thing, with your weapon under your control. The notion that a five-year-old kid, any five-year-old kid, has the capacity to own and possess a firearm with ammunition in it is, I'm where you are. I am so, you know, I have a pretty decent, even though I am moderately opinionated, I have a pretty good ability to understand or at least see both sides of almost everything, even if, obviously if I have a
you
position.
Do?
Yeah, I do, actually. I have, that's one of my better traits,
okay,
I would argue, even if you agree with it. I don't see what the argument is. I don't see it at all. 877-301-8970. And by the way, it's a pipe dream. I mean, the notion that Congress is going to do anything on this is absurd.
Clear.
If 95% of America said they wanted it to happen, just like 90% want universal background checks, they're not doing it. But they should.
Well, you know what is clear? What is clear, since we couldn't even get anything done post-Newtown, although it's heartening to me to see all these senators taking a big dive in the in their poll numbers, including
11-point favorability drop for Ayotte since the vote in 2 weeks.
Yeah, in New Hampshire. And I'm so happy that our neighbors to the north have taken umbrage at her voting against background checks. But what's clear is that there has to be the same kind of organization pro-gun control that there is from the NRA. That what I hope out of this Newtown tragedy is that those parents who have been relentless to date will keep up their relentlessness. Gabby Giffords, by the way, is getting a Profile in Courage
this
award
weekend,
this,
right?
This Sunday, at the Kennedy Library, and good for her. She should get 20 of them. But Gabby Giffords' efforts, the Newtown efforts, they'll get together and be able to raise the kind of money to fight the NRA, because it's all about the bucks, I'm convinced. It's all about the bucks.
877-301-8970. What should we do, if anything, about the fact that it is perfectly fine for 5-year-olds, I assume 4-year-olds, whatever, to be possessing their on their own, owning firearms,
you know what?
which are loaded.
The rifles are practically taller than the children. I mean,
yeah,
that's
I wish you could see these photos.
So incredible.
When the website goes up again, cricketswith2t's.com, you got to check out the kids' corner. I mean, it's unbelievable. Let's start in Lowell. Peter, you're next on Boston Public Radio with Jim and Marjorie. I forgot who we were for a second. Hi, Peter.
Hello, Marjorie. I'm so glad you're on NPR. Some of these issues are getting more.
Oh, Peter, we're going to have to. Peter, we're going
to
put you on hold for a second. We want to hear from you, but the connection is so bad.
Alvin in Salem. What do you think, Alvin?
Well, I have a 5-year-old daughter, and I actually just went out and got her a little rifle.
You did?
Why?
I did.
Why?
Well, I own firearms personally, and I keep them in the house, obviously under lock and key. But I feel that she should be introduced to them safely, and that's what I've been doing, just teaching her, you know, about what they are, the dangers that are involved, obviously. But I, you know, if I'm going to keep them in my house, I think that it's a responsible move to educate her on them.
But you know, Alvin, 5 just seems so young to me. Why can't you wait till she's 8?
Because she's in the house now, and the firearms are in the home now, and I would like her to know how to react and if she ever were encountered with a firearm, whether it's in my home or in any other situation.
Wait. Let me stop you there just for a second, just so I understand. When you like her to know how to react if she's confronted, meaning if someone came into your home who was armed, you want her to know?
No. What do you mean? Absolutely
not.
I mean, there's plenty of accidents and situations where there have been children who are unsupervised. Left with firearms in a
is
home.
She ever left, Alvin? Is she ever left alone with this rifle you bought for her ever?
Absolutely not.
Well,
no.
You know, I'm not crazy about what you did, but it's different from the Kentucky thing. If it turns out you're going to do it and it's perfectly legal, as long as you're with this kid every single second, it wouldn't be my choice. But go ahead.
That's something that I will agree with. I think that, you know, when it comes to using these types of instruments, whether it's a firearm or anything else that's, you know, of any type of danger like that, yeah, they should be supervised. You know, I have a little bit of experience with the cricket firearms and that sort of thing. And it is one of the safer tools, if you will, to train children with. This was, you know, obviously they weren't under proper supervision that obviously.
But I guess, Alvin, what I would wonder, because kids do stuff all the time they're not supposed to do, and things that are hidden away and locked away because they're forbidden fruit are even more tempting. I guess what would be so scary to me is that my kid on a play date, or, you know, mom looks away for 2 minutes, or dad is in the bathroom or whatever, and this kid shows off their firearm. I mean, I think we don't know all the details about this terrible tragedy with the 5-year-old shooting his little sister. And you can just imagine what that child is going to go through for the rest of his life for shooting his little sister. That I would guess their parents didn't anticipate that he was going to get this gun in an unsupervised
situation.
Well,
here's what the coroner says. Gary White, the coroner for that county, says told the Associated Press the rifle was kept in a corner and the family did not realize that a bullet was left inside. One last question, Alvin. We're quite glad you called. Are you going to tell your 5-year-old about the 5-year-old in Kentucky?
I will probably, you know, obviously, you know, I have to be very sensitive about this, but I think that she should know that accidents can happen. They have happened and will continue to happen if mistakes are made and negligence is happening. You know, you have to be very careful with these things. Like I said, we live in Massachusetts. I live in Massachusetts. We have a very, very different view on guns and gun culture here.
Oh, I know. Totally.
You know, so I know that, you know, it would be illegal for me to keep my firearm unlocked, you know, loaded in my home in Massachusetts. Perhaps that's not the case in other jurisdictions, but I think that we should be quite a bit more responsible. It's, you know, because when I see the situation, it makes me look bad. It makes everybody,
got it,
you know, who knows that I have a 5-year-old child at home, and I just, you know, it's like, you know, I'd like to make it better for everybody.
One last thing I'm dying to know, Alvin, is this your oldest kid?
She's my only.
Your only kid. Oh. Because this is probably going to happen at some point. Your daughter is not going to, other parents will not want their kids to come play in your house because you own guns. How are you going to handle that?
I don't know, and it's something that I do think about. You know, the fact that I own firearms isn't something that I necessarily broadcast, although it is something that I am somewhat proud of.
But don't you think, follow up on Marjorie's point, don't you think that the parent of your kid's 5-year-old friend is entitled to know that there are firearms in the house?
Absolutely, and thus far, the parents who have allowed their children to come over and play with my child have been aware.
Good.
But they are also very, very aware of my impeccably clean record.
Yeah.
My responsibility, you know, and everything else. They know that I go above and beyond to make sure that everybody is safe.
Alvin, this shouldn't reflect on you at all, and thank you very much for the call. But from what I understand, there was a clean record in the household in Cumberland County, Connecticut, Kentucky, too. But, Alvin, we're really, really glad you called. Thanks so much for taking the time to do it. 877-301-8970.
You know, I probably told you this story before, but my son came home from a play date when he was about 6 or 7 and started telling me about this gun he saw at this house he was at. And I, of course, went crazy and called the parents. And the mother said, oh, it's an antique gun. It belonged to my grandfather. We have it locked away. It doesn't even work anymore. And that was the last time he went to that kid's house.
How'd your kid react to that? Did he understand?
I just told him I was nervous about guns. I understand. He's great. He can come to our house.
And did he?
Yeah, he did.
Well, good.
And the mother was pretty nice about it. But I think the average parent is going to be totally freaked out about sending their child to a house where locked in a case, unlocked in a case. I just wouldn't risk it.
So the question we're asking at 877-301-8970, at least under state law here, your 5-year-old can't live in a rental unit with lead paint. Your kid can't wear flammable pajamas, all of which we support. But your kid, apparently, at 5 years old, can own a gun. And in Kentucky, this 5-year-old was given a gun as a gift, one of these little cricket guns, My First Rifle, as it's called. And he obviously unintentionally shot and killed his 2-year-old sister. Let's go to Eileen in Holbrook. You're next on Boston Public Radio with Jim and Marjorie. Hey, Eileen.
Hi, how are you? Good. I have a 5-year-old daughter, and I'm shocked I heard your previous callers say that he went out and probably he's teaching his daughter how to use a firearm. For me, I feel like this is not, has nothing to do with his daughter learning values about firearms, because there are no values at 5 years old that you're going to teach a child about a firearm, except for the fact that he's probably trying to either make himself feel better that I could do something cool, make my child feel better about herself, or go out and talk about something that my child has achieved, which is meaningless because they're 5 years old. There are things we can be teaching our children now at this age, and it's not firearms that they need to learn about to be able to get through school, to be able to socialize with kids around them. This is completely, it doesn't make sense. What are you going to teach a child? If somebody walks into the house and an intruder, what are you, leaving your child alone now that they know how to use a gun? Are they going to be carrying a pocketbook with a gun in the back? What value is it right now that this child must learn and must have some knowledge of how to use a firearm or what its purpose is in the house? I don't understand that, because I also worry about, like Marjorie mentioned, what this boy is going to live with daily about the actions he took. This child is going to need therapy.
Forever.
His parents are going to have to live with the consequences of making a big mistake that they thought was probably going to be fun, that the child should know about this. Our children don't have to know about something at 5 years old. I don't teach my child about sex at 5 years old. As much as these things go around, you know, there's things that are age appropriate that our children should learn now, and this isn't one of them. And it's pretty sad. I can hear somebody say, you know, I have an impeccable responsibility. Impeccable responsibility. I mean, my responsibility is to teach my child her math, how to socialize, how to respect people. The firearm part of this is not going to change the fact that this child will not know what to do with it.
Hey, Eileen.
Kill somebody and the violence involved with it.
You said it great. Hey, Eileen, thank you so much for your call. It is. I mean,
I commend Alvin for calling because
no, I do
because he's got I think an unusual perspective.
Well, I mean, let's face it. He's also total in compliance with law. He's not doing anything illegal. He's entitled to do that, and that's how he wants to raise his kid. I mean, you don't have to approve of it, but that's how he wants to raise his kid. Let's go to Marblehead where George is on with Jim and Marjorie, Boston Public Radio. Hey, George.
Hey, Jim and Marjorie, how are you?
Excellent.
Listen, Jim, this is the first time I think in a long time that I agree with you totally.
Shocking, George.
I grew up in Charlestown in the city, and I was exposed to guns when I was younger. I never had one, never liked them. I was a peacenik, and you know, I brought up my children that way. And I have a 12-year-old now, and he does like other people say. You tell him no guns in the house, but they'll make guns out of things, you know, and they play with them.
Yeah, they
fun.
Do.
But he's not going to have a real gun, and he's never going to have a real gun as long as he's in my house, and I'm not going to have one. And, you know, this 5 years old, that's just crazy. Why would you even expose a child to that? Why not let them have their innocence until they're however old, you know, 15 maybe, you know?
But, well, also, George, you know, what you should – what I hope everybody – every person who's a parent here of a kid who's older than 5 years old, think yeah. back to what your five-year-old was able to understand and not understand, and then think about buying them a gun. And by the way, the marketing of this company, which we haven't talked about at all, again, a cartoon character on the box to make it appealing to kids, the ads, which would have played for you, but we can't because the website is down, and that the one for little girls is in hot pink to make
insane.
It more appealing. It is insane. It is totally
it is.
Insane.
Remember Joe Camel? They took him off the package.
Do you know, can I tell you one thing about Joe
great
Camel?
Point, George.
This is my favorite poll ever, and it was on the front page of the Globe about, I don't know, 15 years ago. People, I don't know if they remember, Camel Cigarettes used Joe Camel, a cartoon character, as their sort of mascot for their ads.
Yeah. Yeah.
More kids in America recognized knew who Joe Camel was then I forget what the it was like then George Washington or some
the president. Yeah,
or no it was more than Mickey Mouse. That's what it was. It was compared to another cartoon character because the marketing was so effective. George, it's a pleasure to agree with you for once,
right.
And for you to agree with me for once. We appreciate
nice to talk to you,
thanks,
yeah,
George. You
thank
too.
You for I mean, if you're so inclined to, if you're that into the gun thing, then get a toy gun. I guess. I mean, remember cap guns? Those were big when we were little.
I hesitate to say this because I know the mockery.
You were
six
shooters, too.
I actually had the whole cowboy outfit.
Do you have the chaps?
I didn't have chaps. I wanted chaps. I didn't have chaps. No, I had the, you know, the two six shooters.
Oh, I did too.
All the stuff. You did too?
I was a tomboy. I had a cap gun.
I had all that stuff. It was great. It was my favorite stuff when I was a kid. And that was before it became un-PC.
Yeah.
To,
Annie,
you
know, Oakley. That was me.
I was Annie Oakley too, actually. It's funny you should say that. Let's go to Framingham, where Jeff is on Boston Public Radio with Jim and Marjorie.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I've been listening to these calls and this talk about guns, and my wife was from Louisiana, and the people down there had guns. When they were in the house, they were unloaded. So they weren't used for some mythical robber who was going to come in that they could shoot, because they knew, having guns, that these are often turned against family members rather than Joe Robber.
Right.
And that's when they were used and people went hunting or to get food. But guns are used to punch holes in people. They're punch holes in people or punch holes in animals to kill them. And that's what they're for. They're not fun. They're not nice things to have. And I wonder why a man has to give his daughter this to acquaint her with it. It's not nearly necessary. That's a strange kind of a turn.
You know, also, Jeff, when you said when you grew up, your wife grew up, and I hope I get the facts right, you know, the guns were unloaded in the house. The problem with that, not obviously they were responsible people, and the problem with what Alvin said to us is the parents of the 5-year-old and the dead little 2-year-old sister thought the gun was unloaded. So they thought they were as responsible as everybody we're talking about until it turned out that they made a mistake, the mistake being there was a bullet in this little cricket rifle, and as a result of it, the bullet went into the 2-year-old, and they only have one child now. Jeff, thank you so much for the call.
And for people who, where that's an accident, it's because that usually they are taken too casually and that they are regarded as being wonderful things to play with.
What the safest way, the safest way to deal with it is not to have it unloaded, is not to give it to a five-year-old kid, and then you don't have to worry if it's loaded or not. But, Jeff, thanks for the call. We appreciate it. Well, by the way, as the story develops, we don't know what's going to happen. The parents, have some legal responsibility there. I hope they do, actually. But we'll pursue it, and we'll stay on top of it for you.
We're getting a lot of email on this, and we don't have anybody that thinks it's a good idea for the five-year-old to have a gun. One of the emailers, Monica, points out about the drinking age, you know, the drinking age, and is all these things that you cannot do when you were a child. And I just point out,
why can't you drink at five? I mean, just so you get used to, I'm serious, so you understand how to deal with alcohol.
A lot of emailers are also asking for information about the Mother's Walk, Tina Cherry, and the Peace Institute. And we were going to have all that information for you in the next couple of days because we're going to have Tina Cherry on.
But let me tell you what they can do in the interim. Tina's going to, but if you Google Lewis D. Brown, Lewis, L-O-U-I-S, D. Brown Institute. Google
it. Peace Institute.
Peace Institute, I'm sorry. Lewis D. Brown Peace Institute. You'll go to the site and you'll find out. There's all the information on the Mother's Day March for Peace.
Okay, coming up, it is Open Mic with Emily Rooney. She joins us every Friday at 1 o'clock or a little thereafter. Stick around to get her take on a bunch of professionals who should be served their pink slips effective immediately. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
And then when they get up next to you at a light, rather than take their feet out of their clips, they'll put their hand on your car and lean on it.
Drivers, cyclists, pedestrians, all of us just trying to get where we're going on the tangled streets of Boston. Join WGBH News and Wicked Local for a week of focus coverage, Right of Way. Share your stories about sharing the road at WGBHnews.org.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and the New Bedford Whaling Museum and its major new exhibit, Arctic Visions, Away Then Floats the Ice Island, artist William Bradford's mid-19th century prelude to a changing Arctic landscape. Now open, whalingmuseum.org. And Next Generation Children's Centers, a leader in early childhood education, now enrolling for their infant through full-day kindergarten programs. You can visit ngccenters.com to find a school near you.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. And you see her every night at 7 o'clock on Greater Boston. Well, 4 days a week it's Greater Boston. Friday it's Greater Boston Beat the Press. That's tonight. She's with
me
us
too,
every Friday.
Too.
Oh, and you're on
awesome.
Tonight too?
Me too. Yes, I'm
What'd
so What'd
you say,
excited.
Awesome? Is
yes,
that what you awesome. You didn't use the word awesome.
I did. Sorry.
Oh, my God. And she's with us every Friday at about 1 o'clock. Emily Rooney. Hi, Emily.
Hey, Jim and Marjorie.
How are you?
I'm good.
You know, I love talking to you, Emily, because you have complaints.
I do.
No, I share this first one. She
okay.
and I are on the same page.
Tell us about your complaint about the scene at the terrible
Well, it's a concern. I have a concern that it is attracting what I think Jim and I use the same terminology, professional mourners, people who are sort of like on a mission to come down there and maybe to get on TV or I don't know. I mean, there's a genuine aspect to this. I want to say it's right in my backyard. It's my neighborhood. We were down there. We're doing a piece on this for Beat the Press tonight, too. So most people felt, for instance, the presence of the media was good because it kept attention on this horrible thing. And it's, you know, you don't want to forget about it. But this whole thing about I'm not a big fan of those memorials. I don't like them. There's a tacky quality to it. I mean, this one is a little bit more organized than a lot of these things. It's not just a pile of teddy bears, but still, there's something about it that's.
What can I tell you?
They start to get dirty, yeah, and it rains on the notes,
yeah.
And there's sort of a messy, ugly quality to them after a few
That's
days.
Right.
But they ever since Princess Diana died.
Was that where it started? Really?
I think she
you were
was,
there. Were you there for? You were
I was there,
there
for,
the,
yeah. for the funeral.
I'm
that
not
was
troubled.
One of the first.
The memorial's written about in the Globe. I'm not only okay with that. I like that because it gives people, sincere people, an opportunity to do something in addition to writing a check to the One Fund Boston. What I'm talking about is every time I turn. I don't mean to single out CNN, but I will just for this purpose. On the weekend, you're sitting there. You watch Don Lemon. Don Lemon, one of the weekend anchors, is positioned down in Copley. And, you know, while he's interviewing one person who's expressing their regret, you have somebody, you know, like Al Roker on the Today Show and goes outside and
waving.
Someone's holding a sign.
I know.
I'm from Lowell, Massachusetts. There's that kind
I know.
Of thing.
I know.
And that's where I think the press It's. I guess I'm only a little bit troubled with the professional mourner, as we call it, and more that the press continues to talk to them. I mean, if there's somebody who's got a real emotional connection or a literal connection,
yeah.
I'm perfectly fine.
I'm a little softened on this a bit because this week, for instance, CNN has really kind of turned away from the professional mourners and more to the experts. I mean, they've had Alan Dershowitz almost every single day. So they've been bringing guests down there. And we've actually had a fair amount of breaking news, as you pointed out earlier in the show, on the story. So they've been reporting on that. Now, I did notice that Ashley Banfield is back in New York today, so they might be she's MSNBC, right? Anyway,
yeah.
I think people...
Wait, is she or is she now? Is she
I don't know where she is. I don't
yeah.
know. Anyway, no, I mean, she's CNN. Yeah, she's CNN.
I think she is.
So
too.
They may be clearing out a little bit, though. I don't know what it is. There's an unseemly
aspect. There's a creepy
aspect.
Feeling yeah. to it. And by yeah. the way, a good... I think I pick out Don Lemon because he's the one I see doing the most. You know, it is easy to distinguish, in my opinion, between somebody who's down there with a sincere deal to leave something yeah. in the memorial. And generally, by the way, the people who are the most sincere are the people who least want to talk to a television.
Exactly.
Or at
That's
least
right.
as far as I'm concerned, as opposed to saying, hey,
right.
I'm from Lowell, hey, I'm from whatever. But if it's being reduced, I haven't seen the last
couple
days.
Well, it's a fine line. It's a fine line between the genuine concern and just wanting to do your part and share and maybe go into the Trinity Church. Lots of people going into the Trinity Church afterwards to say a few prayers or whatever, and it becoming a tourist attraction.
Or getting a piece of it, wanting to get in on the action
yeah.
in some way by being on TV or being part. I mean, yeah. That.
And she get any hate email yet on this or hasn't come
no,
in
No, it is
yet.
A fine line because I think there is a lot of genuine. I mean, I've seen it. I've walked by there and I've stood at it any number of times, you know, in the last 2 weeks.
And you almost feel part of it. You feel a little bit that it's almost your duty
yeah, yeah,
that you
right.
should go see the scene of the crime at least once.
Well, do it quietly and humbly is the thing. So how about this piece of this thing that when the anchor, and by the way, I'm a huge Anderson Cooper fan, however... Anderson Cooper, when he interviews one of these people, ends every one of these interviews with how he's feeling their pain. And I want to tell you, he goes, the last 30 seconds is always the commiseration kind of thing. Don Lemon's got his arm around the people who he's interviewing who are down there. I mean, does that crosses the line? Does it not? I mean, I'm not saying you should be asking hard questions of these people, but this feel your
well,
pain
it's,
thing
it's
just
a little
doesn't
bit
do it for
like,
me.
You know, the desire to become part of it. I mean, you know, CNN has been there since the thing happened. They were there that night. And I think they start feeling like they have become part of the community. So, it's all part of that kind of like getting involved journalism. You know, you're involved with the public. You're involved with the people. I mean, what should they do? Should they be complete stoics and not respond in
no,
any
but
way
I think
emotionally?
You can show that you care. I mean, there shouldn't be callousness or hardness.
Well, you
shouldn't cross-examine these people.
Anderson Cooper had a terrible tragedy in his own life where his brother committed suicide, and I believe he witnessed the suicide of his brother. And I think he's new at this sort of tragedy kind of journalism where he's covered all these tragic situations. And I think initially he was stunned that anybody would want to talk to him about any of these tragedies in their own life. So it's almost as if he's treading extra lightly. And I don't want to say older reporters or people who have been doing it for longer get jaundiced about it, but other people I think might be just polite and respectful but less holding on to people's hands.
Mm. And it's all tragedy television. What are you talking about? I mean, I'm not talking about that individual. Almost all this stuff is tragedy television. Last night, Piers Morgan. Did you read about the woman who disappeared 12 years ago?
Of course.
One of the great stories of all time. And she's been homeless for years. The guy, she was declared legally dead. The guy got remarried. So Piers Morgan had the 19-year-old daughter reading from her Twitter account, which was unbelievable, and then they took it down, the husband, who almost couldn't speak, and the new wife, and it's unbelievable. I mean,
Before and after the woman that disappeared, the pictures of that was shocking.
Well, what are you trying to say? They were all just so...
Yes, I am. Yeah. Thank you. Actually, let's move on. You know, yesterday, Emily, we talked about the three 19-year-olds and the UMass connection and how harsh one should be and are they just kids? And caller after caller was saying they're not. Today we read about an 18-year-old, this kid, this young man from Methuen High who intersperses, it says in the Globe, with foul language, says, y'all want me to blank expletive kill somebody? Blank expletive again, a Boston bombing. Wait till you see the blank I do. I'm a be famous rapping and beat every murder charge that comes across me. What do you do with this kid?
You know, I looked at his rap video And I looked at that other kid, Ben Filippo, who's one of the, you know,
Filippo.
They're very similar. You know, one of them is Filippo is talking about somebody who he sort of wants to be like, but he's so inarticulate and completely dumbfounded. He's got this camera on himself, and he's trying to talk to it, and he's stumbling and erring, awning, and stop. This other kid is doing the same thing, in a sense, only through rapping. And I'm looking at these two guys, and I'm thinking, now, is this just common teenage stuff? I mean, or are they genuine morons? I mean, I don't know.
This guy's name is Carmen D'Ambrosio, by the way, the 18-year-old at Methuen High. You know, I'm not I'm not a tough-on-all-crime kind of guy. The most egregious crime, obviously, I am. In normal times, I would say this guy needs a shrink, but this is not normal times. No. You just can't do this kind of thing. Yeah. And it seems to me, I hate those who say you got to make an example. You have to make an example out of this is serious
stuff.
I mean, posted
a terrorist threat, right? I mean, he deserve 20 years?
Well, didn't you report on your show, there was some problem with his sister?
Yeah, he threatened to kill his little sister a year ago. That charge just got dropped last month. So this kid has some serious issues. Although today the spin is, you know, that he's a good kid. He comes from a good family. Well,
they're all good kids.
You
know what drives me crazy about these discussions? And we've heard this a million times from people that don't want any tougher gun laws. What we have to do is deal with the mental health issues. That is such a load of baloney because right in your hometown there, Cambridge over there, they just shut down all these inpatient beds for mentally ill teenagers. We have no intention of doing anything about the mentally ill issues because we don't want to spend any money.
But is he mentally ill?
Well, I think if you're threatening to kill your
younger sister. He needs some sort of treatment if you're threatening to kill your sister.
I think that's a bad sign. It's a red flag, Emily, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, but I wonder if there's not just like hundreds of thousands of kids out there just like him, disenfranchised, feel put out, bullied. I mean, you know, look at Klebold and Harris and those two guys. I mean,
Columbine, are
we just teeming with people like this?
But it seems to me if all you do, let's assume we are teaming with people like this. If an 18-year-old like this who makes headlines because of his threatening Facebook postings that says, I'm going to out marathon the Tsarnaevs, which is essentially what it is, unless you do something really dramatic to this young man, then there's another young man that says there's no price to pay or a small price to pay for essentially threatening terrorism.
What is great is that they're going to give him a dangerousness hearing, and those came to be during Bill Weld's governorship. Because,
explain what that is.
Yeah. Well, because bail is not about how dangerous you are, the amount of money that you have to put in before you're bailed. It's about whether you're going to show up at court, if you have a history, what the crime is, and those sorts of things. I think bail should be much more about dangerousness.
That's what it is, because they haven't set bail yet.
Right.
They won't set it until after.
And what they do with those dangerousness hearings is they look at your history in terms of your mental health issues and what other threatening things you may have done and try to decide how dangerous you are before they let you out. I think that's a great thing. They don't do dangerousness hearings nearly enough in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts or anyplace else.
I think it depends on what you're charged with, whether you can force somebody to do that.
Yeah.
Speaking of dangerous, we want to talk about whether Howard Kurtz, probably the only media critic in America people have heard of, is he dangerous? For those who haven't heard, by the way, the reason we're talking about this, he used to be the Washington Post, Newsweek, Daily Beast. He's probably the only national media critic that anybody's ever heard of. Tell the story about he just got canned. What happened to him?
Let's face it. He is the most quoted media critic anyway. He's written a couple of books. I mean, he appears on CNN. He's the host of Reliable Sources. Now he's with the Daily Beast and Newsweek. He's the Washington bureau chief. He's no longer media critic, but he still hosts a media critic show, and he still does media criticism. So this week he did a column for the Daily Beast about Jason Collins. Jason Collins, of course, is the NBA player who came out on the cover of Sports Illustrated and wrote the whole piece himself. Jason Collins dated a woman for like 8 years, was engaged to be married to her for 3 of them. Howie Kurtz writes in his column that Jason Collins never mentioned the fact that he was married, or he was engaged to be married. Problem is, he did. So Howie at first kind of tried to minimize it and say, well, yeah, he just didn't.
He downplayed it, was the verb he used.
He didn't really develop that angle of the story. And then he apologized. Then the Daily Beast retracted the whole column. And then yesterday they let him go. Now, there's some parsing of words here over whether he was fired. That's a firing in my mind anyway. But we came to a mutual departure. But there's other layers to this. I don't know what they all are, but he's got this extended relationship with a woman named Lauren Ashburn, and he does this other I mean, I found so much stuff today online. He does something called the Daily Download, and then he also does another TV thing called Intermediate or Immediate or something like that. So the complaint was that he was stretched way too thin. But I'm wondering if he just didn't kind of lose his way.
Well, you know,
what I thought was most damning was that according to these pieces I'm reading on the Huffington Post, that he pretended he had an interview with a congressman,
Daryl Issa. Yeah.
He wrote about this interview with a congressman that never happened.
Well, the full story
that's a little disturbing.
In his defense there, to a point, what happened, and this is his most recent offense, as you said, he did an interview, published an interview allegedly with Daryl Issa from California. 2 days after it, according to the key staff person for Issa, the staff person called and said, excuse me, you didn't interview Issa, you interviewed me. This is 2 days after it. And Kurtz's position was, well, I didn't understand. We kept saying congressman. You know, I was confused. But he chose not to make a correction for 6 weeks, meaning that it was 40 days after he was told by this congressional aide that he had made the mistake. Which, you know, it's hard for me, unless you lost it, unless something happened in your brain. I mean, there's a great line on Gawker about the Kurtz thing with Jason Collins. Maybe it's easier to write a lot of media criticism if you don't read the media you're criticizing.
I know, yeah.
I mean, how can you make that allegation if you read the underlying story?
I like Howie Kurtz.
So do I.
I know him quite well.
But I don't
He's
like
very
his
talented.
Work.
He's yeah. very talented. He so it's awful.
I mean, this sloppiness that happens, and sometimes it comes with a lot of fame and adoration. I mean, let's face it. You start really believing that you're flawless, and he's a sharp critic, and he's a pointed critic. And now I think the big issue is for CNN. What is CNN going to do? I mean, if he hosts Reliable Sources this Sunday, is he going to ignore the biggest media story of the week? What's he going to do? Or are they going to let him continue to host the show?
Well, actually, our colleagues have just posted on the board here, Howard Kurtz will keep Reliable Sources' job at CNN. And the question is, what does he talk about?
I agree. Here's always my standard on this, because heaven knows I've made a lot of mistakes in my career, and I think it's often the speed you're doing things, and you do make errors. But you're right. If you make a big blooper, you got to correct it, and you got to try to fix things. And I don't get
if he'd apologized right away, would that have mitigated this?
This thing?
Yeah.
Why didn't he say I screwed up, by the way?
Yeah, right.
You know, I skimmed it. Even if he's
there was
lying,
just one
I
line.
Skimmed the thing.
There was just one line in the Jason Collins piece that said he was engaged. I mean, it was right there, but it didn't go into great detail. It didn't talk about 8 years, but it was right there. So you could. I think that's forgivable to have
but
missed
But you know what gets back to one of our favorite topics, which are sincere apologies.
Oh,
we
I
had
know.
John King with us. I think it was the first time off
made
of CNN.
A huge mistake.
Yeah. He gave an apology that was the most profound
great.
I've ever heard, and if people don't think it was real, then they weren't listening, Carol. I thought it was so real and so intimate and so great.
So very why few did he, people do that.
Exactly. So why didn't Kurtz, unless he's nuts, why doesn't he
well,
just
he was
say,
trying
I
to
really
mitigate.
Screwed up.
He was trying to say it wasn't that big a deal. You just said it wasn't.
Well, to say that he never said he was engaged, and then he did say he was engaged, it's a big, bad mistake in the context of the story about this basketball player being gay. I don't think it's a fireable offense if that's all you've done. Or if he came out and said, you'd feel like a real jerk thinking you were interviewing a congressman. In fact,
clearly there's more
the
to this story. And I can't say what my theory is.
Because I know what her theory is. Let me just say you'd love it, but it is not appropriate.
It's not appropriate for this particular radio show.
Oh, I hope you'll whisper it to me.
I'll write it to you in a couple of minutes.
I'm not going to say it on the air tonight.
So what are you doing tonight, Emily, on
Well, we
Magic
are going to do
7
this.
O'clock.
We're going to do a piece on it. And we're going to also look at, we were just talking about Jason Collins. I mean, we went back and looked at all the media from this week. This is actually kind of funny. So everybody starts it. Big news tonight, groundbreaking. Everybody's talking about Jason Collins coming out. And then the second line, almost to a person, is, not that this should be a story or not that this is a big deal, but then absolutely everybody made a big deal about it. And why? When, you know, people like Martina Navratilova came out 30 years ago, there was a big basketball star, Brittany Griner, whatever her name is, she came out. So it's the fact that, and by the way, Jason Collins focuses on this too, and only he did. No one else picked up on the fact that he said he's black. That makes a difference because, you know, gay white guys are coming out all the time, but African-American sports, so the fact that everybody is kind of making a big deal about it and then saying it wasn't a big deal, but then making the big deal they were making about it is because he's black and an athlete?
See, I think it was – I mean, obviously the guy's black, but I think so much of it is about the macho thing. When you think of who are the most macho people that most people consider in that category, it's NFL players, it's NBA players, it's Navy SEALs, mm-hmm. it's those, you know, those kind of professions. So I think – I mean, obviously the black thing is part of it, but I thought the big thing was that in one of the most macho
– No, it is.
This is a – because he's the only one who's come out who's actively playing in the NFL or the NBA.
But it's like it doesn't matter. All these other people who have done it, it does. Oh, that doesn't mean anything.
Because they're women.
Because they're women.
Well, yeah. We're not talking.
Everybody's a lesbian. You know, I feel about that. That's sort of the, that's the attitude. In
well, look at Elena Kagan. She was on a softball team. Yeah. Okay, she must be gay.
She's a Supreme Court justice for those who don't know. Emily, right. We'll be watching you at 7,
okay,
and we'll see you next
later,
Friday.
Marjorie.
Thanks so much.
Okay, Emily.
I'm going to tell you later,
Marjorie,
what she
yeah,
really
Yeah, you
thinks.
Better tell me. I'm dying to know. Emily Rooney, and catch her tonight at 7 o'clock on Beat the Press. I'm going to be on Beat the Press with Emily tonight, too. I'm very excited about it. Tune in on Monday at 1 o'clock for Open Mic with Gene Rivers. Okay, yesterday, Rhode Island became the 10th state in the country to legalize gay marriage. We'll dig into that story next on 89.7 WGBH.
Prom is important at most any high school, but at Euler School in Cincinnati, it means a whole lot more.
They'll leave saying it was whack, you know, but they have had the most phenomenal time that they'll remember for the rest of their lives, and that's why we have to have prom.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Prom and economic adversity next time on Marketplace. It's from APM.
Tonight at 6, here on WGBH Radio.
Funding for our programs comes from you and New England Eye Center, affiliated with Tufts Medical Center. Vision correction options continue to expand from all laser LASIK to laser cataract surgery. Info about New England Eye Center and their refractive surgery team at mylasikdoc.com. And WGBH2, Sunday nights take a journey across the pond and back in time. The drama begins with Call the Midwife at 8, followed by Masterpiece's Mr. Selfridge at 9. Sundays on WGBH2.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan.
Sue O'Connell is here from Bay Windows. Now, we're going to talk about what just happened in Rhode Island. But before we get to that, we were just talking with Emily Rooney about the whole Jason Collins controversy. And people were saying, well, you know, it's a big deal, but it's not a big deal. And all these lesbians have come out before. Now, you're gay.
Yes,
you're a lesbian.
I am.
So I want to hear from you. I think it is not such a big deal for lesbians to come out because they've been coming out since Billie Jean King.
Well, not only that, but in every aspect of life, including music, where we all knew Elton John was gay, but Melissa Etheridge came out first. Katie Lang came out first.
Great
It
point.
Has been easier for women to come out as gay.
Why?
I think because people are less offended by lesbians and are
Absolutely.
Less offended by lesbian sex, if I need to go there.
You just
and
did.
I did. And I think that it's just less scary to people than gay men. And I think that men just, you know, I think they would pay a higher price. Now, to the sports issue, you know, until people start actively betting on the WNBA, it won't be as big as the NBA. So, you know, lots of women have come out in sports. And, you know, I say it's a big deal for Collins because if it wasn't a big deal, there'd be more openly gay players. I mean, it's sort of it isn't a big deal in our world, but in the sports world it is because he's the only one.
Well, I have one more theory about this. It just said to Emily Rooney, it's about the uber macho thing. And that's when you have one of these guys that is supposedly doing the most macho thing you could possibly be, which is being in the NBA or being in the NFL. And he says, you know what? A gay guy can be just as macho as Charles Barkley.
Well, think about how screwed up this is, though. The military was
exactly
people don't ask, don't tell, where was repealed so that gay folks can serve openly. They have more gay people out than sports did. I mean, it's kind of completely backwards. I mean, they're just playing
That's
a game.
Point, by
they're
the
just
way.
Grown-ups
That's
playing a,
good
a game and getting paid
Do
a lot of money.
Do we have a gay Navy SEAL?
I don't know. I'll go find out. I'll go undercover.
We'll ask Gabriel Gomez that question.
Okay. Why we invited you here, even though we're thrilled that you waited on the Collins thing, here's Governor Lincoln Chafee of Rhode Island yesterday, the signing of the gay marriage bill. He talked about those who didn't live to see marriage equality in that state.
I want to say a few words to our many, many LGBT family members, friends, and neighbors all across Rhode Island. I know that you have been waiting for this day to come. I know that you have loved ones who dreamed this would happen, but did not live to see it. But I am proud to say that now, at long last, you are free to marry the person you love. Thank you.
Okay, that's Lincoln Chafee. And what I wanted to ask you, I don't know if we've had this discussion before. I think we have. So 10 states in D.C. now, same-sex marriage legal. 31 states, is it? So 30-something have constitutional amendments that ban gay marriage. Some of those also ban civil unions, whatever. But so it's like 31 to 10. I don't know what the state of the other nine are. But what happens next? Essentially, well, I guess what I'm saying is everybody's taken sides. They've either taken sides legislatively, judicially, like Massachusetts did, or they've had their constitutions amended. If the Supreme Court doesn't make the broadest ruling on Proposition 8 in California, which it's not going to do, I think we know that. They may do something that legalizes gay marriage in California. They're not going beyond that. What happens? I mean, these are constitutional amendments. They're not laws that legislators can be pressured into making changes about. What happens?
Well, I think we in Massachusetts are best equipped to answer that because we're one of the oldest commonwealths in the United States. We have laws on our books that we don't enforce anymore. We don't have a constitutional amendment, which is obviously a big deal for folks who may not know it. To actually change the constitution of a state is a big deal. But I think what will happen, and to Governor Chafee's point, you know, I'm taking the really big, long view on this. Marriage equality for gays and lesbians across the United States is an inevitability. And whether or not it's going to be 40 years from now that one of these states that has a Defense of Marriage Act, they just stop enforcing it like we stopped enforcing the 1913 rule against interracial marriage, which was still on the books in Massachusetts that Tom Riley used to keep out-of-state gays from getting married legally in Massachusetts.
Former Attorney General
in Massachusetts. It will just, you know, I think it will just dwindle
but so
away.
But is that what it is? I was afraid that was going to be the answer. Yeah. I was hoping there was a different one. So basically what I think you're saying is unless the Supreme Court all of a sudden gets it from your perspective and ours, actually, then you just sit back and wait. Is that is
well,
that
I think I said this last time I was on. From a bird's eye view that we are moving ahead on this in a step-by-step basis in a fabric of both elected officials and courts and in different ways makes it a much stronger case for marriage to stay open to all. But on the other hand, as Chafee said, there are people who don't have benefits that live in states that aren't going to get it, that are, you know, not being able to visit their loved ones at hospitals. So on a human toll, it hurts. But in the large view, we're getting there and we will get there. We have had an expedited amount of progress in civil rights compared to other groups, including women, including African Americans, I think basically because we've been sleeper cells, you know, all across America.
Sleeper cells.
We have been your sisters. We have been your sons and daughters. We've been your dentist. And all of a sudden, you know, we came alive and said, you know, we want the same rights as you.
Well, that's what the polls, speaking of sleeper cells, we've said this about 3,000 times, Marjorie and I both. You look at the polls, which now for the first time ever show a majority of Americans support gay marriage. The two demographics in which the largest majorities, young people, 18 to 29, it's like 80% or some insane thing, and people who say they know a gay person. So if you don't think you know a gay person, you're against it in many cases. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden you find out, oh my God, the next door neighbor, the guy who fixes my plumbing is gay. It changes
everything.
For everybody.
Changes
but
everything.
The problem is, as I think we've learned from this pathetic gun control debate in Congress, the fact that popular opinion changes doesn't cause
but
people...
But it's a totally different...
Why
I mean,
is it totally
because
different?
Because I think that there's just a natural evolution of... You have a generational divide, which I don't think you have on the gun control issue and the gun
That's
regulation
a good point. Yeah,
issue,
okay.
That every year a bunch of people die who are against same-sex marriage and more people are born and change their minds
but wait a
or
second.
Evolve into
but
it.
There's got to be, of the 31 states, and if I'm off by one, my apologies, but 30-some states that have constitutional amendments, there's got to be one of those states, or 10 or 12, where a majority of people in a poll have said, I support gay marriage.
Absolutely.
In the X number of years since we voted for the Constitution. There's no move in any of those states to cause the Constitution to come in line
right
with the popular will
but
is,
no,
right?
Not right now.
I think she's absolutely
not
right
now.
Though. There absolutely will be because you hear even in these evangelical groups who say, you know, God is against gays, even young evangelicals who are going to the God thing,
differ with their parents and their grandparents.
So we just have to wait?
We have to wait, and we have to see if enforcement will continue on it. I think when the federal government recognizes it, it will change dramatically on the state-by-state level. I mean, I think, again, I know people suffer from this and their inability to enter into marriage equality. But at the same time, this is a great way to show America how things can change in a way that just don't totally blow everything up. You know, people will be able to go to states and get married. They will be able, God willing, to have their marriages federally recognized. And it's just a step-by-step. Plus, a lot of those states don't have a lot of people in them. You know, I mean, we can say 30 to 10 in D.C., but the reality is if you look at the distribution of the population, the states with same-sex marriage rights have more people.
Well, actually, the final thing that I don't know what the percentage is, you may know, but what I read right after the argument on DOMA and Proposition 8 is that if the Supreme Court allows gay marriage to happen in California, while we'll only make 11 states that allow plus DC, it's something like 40% of the population.
California is the size, the economy the size of Italy.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we have to keep these things into perspective. So, and I know that there are greater minds than mine, like Mary Bonanno and the folks at Gay and Lesbian Advocates and Defenders, who are plotting, you know, what in a good way, what do we do if this happens? How do we get there? What do we do here? And I'm sure if we review all of those states that have a Defense of Marriage Act, if we review their constitutions, I bet we will find ways that the amendment doesn't hold.
We love upbeat guests. Sue O'Connell, thanks so much.
One last thing that you didn't mention when you talked about why it's easier for lesbians to come out.
Why?
Because there are all sorts of straight men, I'm not going to name any names, who spend their time cruising in lesbian chat rooms.
Like Jim Browdy.
No,
that's where I met Jim,
no,
actually.
Like, no,
I thought Jim was
totally
a leggy female tennis player.
Thank you, Sue O'Connell.
He fooled us
Bay
all.
Bay Windows and South End News. That segment went about 20 seconds too long by Mariah Stan. Sue, great to see you, Sue.
So here's our question to you guys. What do Mitt Romney, Elvis impersonators, and a plate of rice and beans have in common? They are all fair game on our Friday news quiz. That's up next, 89.7 WGBH.
A lot of people are calling basketball player Jason Collins a hero for coming out as the first openly gay male athlete in a major American sport. But we're wondering if that somehow sells short the female pioneers who came out years earlier. The Barbershop Guys toss that around next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 2, here on 89.7 WGBH.
We love our contributors. That means you. And Davis Mom and DeAugustine, PC, attorneys at law, knowing the lay of the land, not just the law. On the web at davismalm.com, DAVISMALM.com. And M. Steinert & Sons, introducing customers to the joys of playing music, New England's source for Steinway and other fine pianos for more than 150 years, with showrooms in Boston and at the Natick Mall, msteinert.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan here with us in Studio 3 for an interfaith gathering is Father Tim Skenk. He's the rector of the Episcopal Parish of St. John the Evangelist in Hingham. Father, it's great to meet you in person.
Thank you. Pleasure.
And you're the guy behind Lenten Madness that we talk. Is that correct?
Lent Madness. Absolutely.
Lent Madness. Thank you. We love that. And also,
that was a riot. All the saints.
It was sort of like March Madness in the brackets, except for whatever.
Except some saints end up getting re-martyred.
Thank you. And here is Rabbi Moshe Waldox. He's with the Independent Non-Denominational Congregation, Temple Beth Zion in Marjorie's hometown of Brookline, co-editor of the Big Book of Jewish Humor. It's now in print for more than 30 years. Rabbi Moshe works actively in interfaith organizations in the greater Boston area. Rabbi, great to see you.
Nice to be here.
Now, Rabbi, I graduated number one in my bar mitzvah class from Temple Beth Zion in Philadelphia. What does that do for you?
Did you continue on?
What's the question?
Did you continue on?
No, but that's one of the reasons
that's
I wanted
what
you
leaves
here
today. A lot of us with 13-year-old theology. It's really one of the big issues we face.
Thank you very much for your.
but it can be solved, that problem.
Can I add one quick thing on a serious note before we get to this quiz? This interfaith service, we played it live on the air 11 to 12:30, obviously on the Thursday after the marathon. But we thought it was one of the most moving things ever. Not only the religious leaders, but the president and Deval Patrick and Tom. And the whole thing was great. Is that like a one and done kind of thing, Father? Or I mean, meaning, is there anything happening post that in the interfaith community vis-a-vis what happened on April 15th?
Well, I hope so. It all speaks to our common humanity. I don't know of anything in particular, although us simply being here, does that count?
Well, it counts for us.
Oh, good.
But you're shaking your head up and down. What's going on?
You may be aware, and I hope you have them on sometime, the Greater Boston Interfaith Organization.
Yeah.
So GBIO, the Sunday after, we had a gathering of all of us, and we dealt with the issue of you know, having Markey was there and Lynch was there and four people running. And we like to hold politicians, keep their feet to the fire about current issues. Of course, we talked about this issue, but we what was important was we said, you know, the bombing was horrible, you know, but since that bombing till the next Friday, 12 people were shot.
We talked about that earlier.
So if they would have been hit with a bomb, would you get 9,000 people out there to solve it? So that was what we brought up, because ultimately we have to live here every day.
And you know, many of those politicians have 13-year-olds' understanding of political issues. Have you noticed that as well?
Well, they all agree they're against people shooting each other with guns.
That's a good thing.
That was a step forward.
Let's start the quiz. And, Marjorie, you know, I think it'd be nice if we did like a cross-religious kind of thing. Why don't you have your first question for the rabbi?
Well, I have a little problem with my quiz. I hope the first one. Do I have the right question here?
That is correct. Yes, you do.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure I misplaced in all my papers my quiz questions.
Rabbi Moshe, this is for you.
Okay.
Okay, we're going to play you a little sound here and ask you who this person is and why she's making this particular appeal. Here it is.
The mission today, the prayer breakfast today, was to seek about redemption and slowing down in life and finding purpose. It really touched my heart. I've made some mistakes in the past, but I'm trying to look forward with my family.
Got to give him a little clue. That's
now,
a hard one.
Now, the key here is that she did make mistakes in her past. We all watched her make these mistakes. Well, we watched her after she made the mistakes, and we noticed that she had a great pair of arms. Remember who this might have been?
Great pair of arms.
Great pair of arms. It's not Michelle Obama.
It's not Michelle Obama. No,
another woman with a great figure. The whole thing was pretty impressive, actually.
Was that the attractive district attorney that...
What'd she do?
I'm saying the one that Obama said was the most...
The Attorney General from California.
No.
Great answer. That's wrong. You want to steal the question, Father Tim?
No, I actually don't.
This is a tough question.
Give him the answer.
Paula Broadwell, who was carrying on
General Petraeus.
She was very well built.
That was at a prayer breakfast in Charlotte.
Not that anybody noticed, of course. Yeah.
Okay. Father Tim, this is for you. The question is simple. Who is this, and what is the gift that she has received?
I have been on this incredible journey for the last 6 years. And receiving this wonderful gift ends this chapter in my life. What a great way to move forward with what life has for me now.
And the question is, again, this is really an inspirational story. Who is she and what's the gift that she's talking about? Please, Father
that
Tim.
That is the woman who received the face plant.
That is correct.
No, yes. Not the face plant, the face implant.
Face
that's something
transplant.
Else.
Transplant.
Right. Transplant.
Yeah.
And I guess that's somewhere in between, in the grand scheme of things, and it is very inspirational. I guess that's somewhere in between a nose job and a heart transplant. Wouldn't that fall somewhere in between?
Yeah, it's an unbelievable story.
And by the way, there's a bonus question since you're doing so well. We interviewed him a couple of weeks ago, and he was spectacular. Speaking of inspirational, can you name the famous face transplant surgeon who has done either virtually all or all the face transplants in the United States, Father Tim? Who is
I got is Brigham and Women's.
Well, that doesn't count. How about you, Rabbi?
Remembering his name, it's Dr. Something.
It is Dr. Something. It's Bodon Pomahawk.
Pomahawk.
I just said that. Pomahawk. That's correct.
And what extraction is that?
I think he's Czech. Is he not? Is he a Czech?
Yes, he came here. He came here from Czechoslovakia, and he had to persuade the Brigham to even embrace this face transplant operation because it's very expensive. It hadn't been done. One had been done in France. He saw all five of the ones in the United States. We had a chance
to interview him.
This was an exceptionally good job, by the way.
Oh, it's fantastic. Stunning. It is really stunning.
You see how they've advanced over the years.
You do. You do. And they've only been doing them, for 2 years now?
And a couple of years.
Not very long. But he did the woman also that was mauled by the chimpanzee. He's incredible.
Okay, after one round, Father Tim is leading 1-0. Here's your chance to redeem yourself.
Not that we are competitive.
Yes, we are.
We are. Okay, in that case, Shoot it.
Now,
go
Rabbi,
ahead,
one of the things I should point out, though, because you told me that your temple is right near my house, mm-hmm. and I have noticed, because there used to be very few people in there. Now there's lots of people in there, and you've done wonderful things with the plantings outside.
Yes,
I've noticed that,
yes.
too. You've got the beautiful flowers and shrubs and everything else, because you're a funny guy. I guess that's one of the reasons why people like you so much.
That's what they say.
Okay. All right.
What's the question?
These words got a lot of attention this week. Who is this rabbi? What's the venue?
If you meet a person you love, get married. Have a quiver full of kids if you can.
Do you know who that is talking?
This is a rabbi.
No, it is not.
He's not a rabbi.
Right. Quiver full of kids.
Yes.
Yes.
Uh-huh. It isn't Robin Hood, so I'm just checking that out.
No.
You want a clue?
A clue, yes.
He might have said a binder full of kids if he was in a different mood.
I see. He's still saying things, isn't he?
He is.
Mm-hmm. Mitt Romney.
That would be exactly correct. Right. Did we lose the bell? Oh, here's the bell.
Oh, God. That's wonderful. I was waiting for Beulah the buzzer, if you remember her.
We do very well. By the way, before we go back to Father Tim, who did not get the bell, you were the co-editor of the Big Book of Jewish Humor. Right. It's 23 reprints or something.
Yeah, it's been around forever.
What's the best? I know you hate this
What's
kind of
the best
question.
Joke? They're all my children.
Okay, fine. Give us one quick one,
Well,
please.
Speaking, I'll give you a quick one. The one having to do with face transplants. Yes. About an older guy. After he's 80 years old, he loses his wife after 50 years, decides he's going to pull it together, and he has a face job, and finally he gets hit by a truck. He goes up to heaven. He says, how could that be? I was rebuilding my life, and God says, I didn't recognize you.
That is horrible. You should be ashamed, Rabbi.
Let me get this straight. You can just pull a face transplant joke just from out of the air.
Yes, because I'm imbued by the spirit of Groucho Marx.
But right. Father Tim had the great. Did you explain the brackets, the Saints
we
brackets,
started,
instead
yes.
of being like the brackets for the
for
the
March Madness?
Yeah.
Yeah.
There were brackets for Saints.
Right, we put 32 Saints in a bracket, and only one can win.
Who did win?
Who did win? We didn't. Yes. Yeah.
Oddly enough. Francis Perkins. Now, Francis
Perkins. Former Secretary of Labor, the first woman appointed
and Mount
by FDR.
Holyoke graduate.
Yeah.
Wow.
She, there was this big coalition, I guess, between Mount Holyoke and the Department of Labor, conspiracy theory stuff. Mm. But she ended up defeating St. Luke. So I don't know if the AMA didn't do their thing. I don't know.
You haven't written a big book of Episcopal humor, have you, Father Tim?
I'm doing research as we speak, yes.
Right. He is Father Tim Skank. He's from Hingham. And we're talking also to Rabbi Moshe Waldox. He's from Brookline.
Okay.
Oh, I asked the next question.
You asked the next question.
Here it is, Father Tim. Tonight the Celtics play a do-or-die game 6 against the Knicks at TD Garden. Question is, what was it that the Knicks players wore before Wednesday's game that got people like this ESPN analyst so worked up? Listen.
Just because you play a professional sport does not make you a professional. And last night, they weren't professional. If you're going to show up looking like that, if you're going to talk the talk, you better walk the walk. And last night, the Knicks, they didn't have a pulse.
Okay, wow. So the question again is...
Yep.
What was I don't know what the question is.
Yeah, they were men in black.
Oh, that is exactly right. They all black because their line was what? Why'd they wear black?
I don't know.
Good. Thank you, Father Tim. A little rather dismissive of the questions. Don't you think? Because it was going to be a Celtics funeral.
Oh, that's right.
Exactly. Do you know that one, Rabbi, or not?
I read that they wore black. I wasn't sure.
You had no idea why?
No, I had an idea. It was a little bit about the fact that they were mourning.
What's the second best joke in the big book of Jewish? I know they're all my children. They're all my grandchildren, whatever.
Oh, they're very hard to find a quick one.
You have a second? We'll give you a...
Yeah, give me a break here.
Okay, give you a minute. Go ahead, Margaret.
But you guys are both funny clergymen. I think it's really fun to have more joking and more joy.
You know, people often confuse solemnity with seriousness.
They do.
Right. And if they think of it solemn, it's got to be serious. But I have found, like, for instance, every Kol Nidre, the most important service of the year on Yom Kippur, I spend all summer thinking for the right joke. Because the sermon's easy. You didn't do as well last year as you could. Do better. I mean, that's the sermon. But the right joke opens the heart. And when you open the heart, you can put a lot more in.
I'm not exactly looking to make jokes on Good Friday. But I will say that God has a sense of humor. And if not, I'm hosed. So.
Right.
That's
beautifully
true.
Put,
and
Father.
There's always a debate about when after... tragic things. When we had this conversation with comedians after 9/11 and even after the Boston Marathon bombing, when can you start to be lighter and
humor is very, very healing.
I'm with you. Right. I think it absolutely is, but other people view it as offensive. You know,
do you remember that sermon, one of the most incredible gatherings I've ever seen? It was the first huge gathering in Madison Square Garden. The thing was hosted by Billy Crystal. It was a fundraiser for 9/11. Right. The front 5,000 seats were filled by the relatives of cops, firefighters, and other first responders who had died on 9/11. And Billy Crystal started telling jokes about the Taliban and about Al-Qaeda. And you say to yourself, oh, my God, how can he do? And it, you're right. It was so healing. Mm-hmm. And the camera focused on the family members. And they finally needed a release. And that, that was the release. It was great.
Mel Brooks says that all comedy is tragedy plus time.
That's a great line.
Yes. That's a great line.
One of our great philosophers, Mel Brooks.
Love him.
Okay. Absolutely.
Okay, Rabbi, here's a question for you. Jay Leno is going to be – here's Jay Leno. He's talking about President Obama's travel. And the question is, what country is he talking about? Plus, a bonus question, who's the leader of the country he's meeting with? Here's
– And President Obama is in right now. He'll be on hand to celebrate economic successes over the last few years. See, that's how it works now. If President Obama wants to celebrate an economic success, he actually has to leave the country and go to another place. Because, yeah, that's the way it works.
That was not nice.
That was not.
But what's the question, Marjorie?
May
the question
true.
Is, what country was Jay Leno talking about?
Is this a recent trip?
Recent trip.
Current trip.
And
current
the leader,
trip.
The leader of that country he's meeting with, they used to be struggling. They're not struggling.
Yes, it's
so
Mexico.
That is correct.
Good.
Give him half a point.
It used to be Calderon. The new guy is Jose
Cuervo.
Jose Cuervo.
That's really nice.
Right.
That's,
I think Rabinowitz is the last name. Rabinowitz. Jose Rabinowitz.
He used to go by that
He used to go. He changed his name. Who? Yeah. What's his name?
It's Enrique Peña Nieto.
Nieto.
That is exactly
interesting.
Right.
But it was very fascinating to see how Mexico is trying to stop talking only about drug cartels.
That's right. I'd never heard of them either.
Even though it's a very prosperous business.
Yes, Father Tim, you want to say
this
something?
This Sunday is Cinco de Mayo. Yes.
Oh, that's a very good point.
And so one of the real questions in my own parish is, do we put salt on the rim of the chalice or not?
That's a real good question.
And we're just not quite sure.
And
how
what's
how
the
to
answer?
That.
Well, you have to answer it.
You have to show up.
Okay, fine.
Okay, Father Tim, here's what I want to know. There's this old wives' tale that none of us can get diseases from the wine in the Episcopal
that's
Church, the Catholic Church, because the alcohol content is so high that it kills all those germs. And I've noticed if you go to Mass or your Sunday service on an empty stomach and you have a good swig, you get a little buzz on.
Yeah.
Look, Jesus is not going to give you the flu. Let's start there. Right. But it's
unresponsive,
not a problem.
But okay, fine.
Not a
Here's
problem.
A question
okay.
for you. Right. By the way, the score is 2-2.
Yeah, and by the way, I still haven't gotten a bell for the two questions.
Okay.
Thank you.
There it is for both questions.
I see. Okay, I'm glad he's awake in there.
So. Now, are you ready for this? Yeah. No, she is, too.
She
now,
is,
here
okay.
is the question for Father Tim Skank. You can take the lead with this, Father. What Ben Affleck news story are these pop-cultured hosts talking about? Here they are.
Can't afford the dollar menu.
Don't take Jennifer to dinner.
Ben Affleck's the best human.
Goodwill, Hunting, and Gathering.
And the question is, what Ben Affleck news story are these pop culture hosts talking about, Father Tim?
Yes, that would be the Affleck celebrity diet of spending $1.50 a day in solidarity with a billion of people that live on $1.50 a day.
Can we hear a bell? Oh, that
Thank
was very
Thank you
good.
Very much.
By the way, we talked about this with Callie Crossy. What do you think, seriously, what do you think about doing something like that? Does it make the point? Does it get people focused
on
this art?
It gets us talking about it. It's a little hypocritical, I think.
Why?
Because
he doesn't give up all his wealth to do it?
Well, for one thing, it was supposed to be a 5-day challenge, and what I understand is he did 1 day. I mean, you know, again, $1.50 for 1 day, great, good for him, but
Got it. How about you, Rabbi?
I agree. We have a number of congregations where the rabbi and some of the congregants did a month and $33.50. Yeah, I think it's symbolic and it's very nice, but the deeper charity would be to make sure that you're doing the work all year round to make sure people can support themselves. That's really the highest work we
tough,
can do.
I'll tell you.
What did you say you did where people did what for
$33.50? A month for $33.50. I mean,
it was
an idea.
The concept.
Whatever
yeah.
it was. Yeah. Whatever it was. It was basically this idea that we will live the way people have to live.
And what was that like? Normally. I mean, that's one day you sort of you hold your breath. What
I didn't
it like
do it.
For?
I didn't do it because I think it's with my appetite, I guess you couldn't do it.
That's beautiful.
I paid $3 for a cup of coffee at Red Eye Roasters in Hingham.
That's totally true.
Yeah. Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, even on peanut butter, I don't think you could do it.
Yeah. Next question is for Rabbi Moshe here. Go ahead.
Here's a clip from Stephen Colbert. What over-the-counter drug is Stephen Colbert talking about?
Is my job, sadly,
to report more disturbing news from the folks over at the FDA.
The FDA announcing that Plan B will be available to children as young as 15 years old and no prescription needed.
Oh, so they're handing out hussy pills to 15-year-old girls like Chiclets. But I still need to show my passport and provide a DNA sample to buy some damn Sudafed. How am I supposed to make my meth?
Now, hopefully you weren't listening to that carefully because we forgot to bleep the things.
But I also I heard that on just – it was last night or the
you
night,
did.
Night before.
So you're
yeah. –
you raise your right – well, you're actually your rabbi. You don't right. have to raise your right hand. You're telling the truth. Go ahead. Yeah. So
no, what I'm saying it's Sudafed.
Did you really know the
meth.
Answer?
Absolutely.
You did. No, it's not Sudafed and meth. That's not the answer to the question.
Well, I mean, it was the Plan B.
Oh, the plan – okay, yeah, fine. Do we give him the points? Father, do we give him the points or not?
Well, you just did.
That's
so
good.
After the fact, he can't take it back.
True. Right? So actually, it's a tie. And here's your opportunity with almost no time left, Father Tim, to do something, to take a lead. Here we are. What structure is this construction worker speaking about? Listen.
We're going to be hoisting a 22-ton structure that will house all state-of-the-art lighting facilities as well as a beacon that will be seen for miles around. And give a tremendous indication to people around the entire region and the world that we're back and we're better than ever.
Okay, what's the answer? What structure is that construction worker talking? It's not your question,
something
Rabbi, please.
Something tall in Boston.
That would be wrong. You can swipe the... Oh. Look how excited the rabbi is. This is vicious. Rabbi, look at the smile on his face. Rabbi
it's
Moshe.
The spire on top of the New World Trade.
That is exactly right.
Which will make it a tremendously tall...
1776.
Yeah, I was too busy watching TMZ to prepare for this.
How about the guy? How about the guy's New York accent when he said state of the art, however he said it? I mean,
state of the art is Boston.
It's Boston, but he said it... How did he say it? You're from New York.
I'm not from New York. I live there.
How did he say state of the art?
He said it in a New York kind of way. Yeah. Now, did you find the rabbi's behavior uncharitable, Father Tim, and the glee that you got it wrong and he got it? Did you feel that way?
I felt slighted, marginalized.
I apologize.
We only have a minute left. Here's your chance to tie it up, Father Tim.
I'm just
Tim
so surprised Skin. That I knew the answer, that's all.
It's too late, Rabbi. This person made big news this week. Who is this and what's he talking about?
I never set out to be the first, and it's, you're sort of waiting around for somebody else to... raise their hand, and I'm ready to raise my hand, but you still look around like, okay, come on, guys.
That would be the Bishop Gene Robinson of the NBA, Jason Collins.
My goodness, Gene Robinson was an Episcopal bishop
who
was gay, who represented
gay bishop.
That was a big brouhaha for a while.
Yes, it was.
Quite. Yeah, is it now, still or have things calmed
he's
down?
He's gone.
I know he's gone, but
he's
the whole
retired.
Issue.
You can still find him on Twitter,
right? Is the issue still there, or are we beyond it now in the Episcopal Church?
Oh, I think. Most of us are beyond it,
yeah.
But it's still an issue.
We have another question, but we're going to leave it at 4-4 because that sounds sort of ecumenical or something.
Yeah.
Now, Father Tim, if people want to find you in Hingham, if they find you an appealing character and would like to find you, your church, whatever, how do they do that?
Well, they can go to our website, which is www.stjohns-hingham.org, or, of course, they can find me on Twitter at Father Tim.
That's an easy
and
one to
remember. Rabbi Moshe Waldox. We know they can go, guy, the big book of Jewish humor on whatever you call it, Amazon.com and elsewhere. How do they find Temple Beth Zion?
We are on Beacon Street, west of Coolidge Corner, 1566, between Coolidge Corner and around the corner from Marjorie's house.
That's right. It's a beautiful temple.
Rabbi, it was a pleasure to meet you. Thanks so much for being here.
My pleasure. And Shabbat Shalom to everybody.
Thank you. And Father Tim, it was great to have you, too.
Pleasure.
Shabbat Shalom to you, too.
Appreciate it.
That's it for this week, everybody. We thank you for listening. And we want to thank the folks who work on this show, and we never mention them. We really should. We have Edgar B. Herrick III, Alan Mattis, Chelsea Mers, John Parker, Will Roselip, and Abby Ruzica. They are spectacular, and without them, there would be no show.
That is very true, Jim.
Find us on the web at wgbhnews.org/BPR, on Twitter at BOS Public Radio, and you can follow me on Twitter at Jim Browdy, and soon you can also follow Marjorie Egan. I'm sorry. It is what it is, Marjorie. She has a Twitter account, but she's not quite.
I'm getting there.
In any case, have a wonderful weekend. I am Jim Browdy.
I am Marjorie Egan.
And we will see you Monday at noon. Thanks so much for being here.